Thank you, and thank you for the invitation to be here and to talk and all that. And let's see, let's get off a few apologies. Some of the work that I'll talk about is getting old, and the rest of it is nowhere near ready. So I'm in a bit of an in-between land, but the cruel organizers refuse to let me off the hook, so I have to talk. So let's see what I can do with that. One other apology is that this is a physics group, and I am not totally confident of my physics. So many of the physics questions I may not be able to answer. Fortunately, there have been some previous talks, especially Sakura's talk last week, which I think have covered at least most of the material that I need. So I will defer to her on physics questions. So with some apologies out of the way, let me give you some references. So there's an old paper of Curio and myself from 1998, moduli in n equals 1 heterotic F-theory duality. So when I said some of the work is old, I meant old. Mostly I meant old as in a year old. So there's a series of papers that I wrote with Martin Weinholt, and I should have said right away that everything is together with Martin Weinholt. So we had one paper, this is in the new system, so now it has one extra digit. 802.2.9.6.9, model building with F theory, and then second installment a few months later, gut breaking in F theory. I will also be using a survey paper that Martin wrote. Basically summarizing the other two papers, so that's a month later than that. It's called F-Theory, Guts, and Chiral Matter. And EW3 is in progress. So the heterotic compactification is specified by a three-dimensional Calabi-Yau threefold Z together with a principal E8 cross E8 bundle V, which is the sum of two E8 pieces. And it needs to satisfy the anomaly cancellation condition, which is that C2 of the manifold matches C2 of the bundles. Or if you are in an N-theory version of this, then you get a correction for the five brains. So this is the anomaly cancellation. Typically, there is some structure group, H, which is a proper subgroup of E8 cross E8. Usually, it sits only in one copy of E8. And that defines the gauge group G to be the centralizer in E8 cross E8 of the structure group H. So G is going to be the gauge group. H is the holonomial, the group to which you can reduce the structure of the bundle. Question?
We just like semi-direct C2 on the
Yeah, that's physics notation, I guess. No? That's not even physics.
It's a disconnected group.
Sure.
So, semi-direct C2.
With the Z2 acts as the automorphism that exchanges the two V8s.
Cross it to, did it fit in the right place? Let me.
Not in G, but in H is contained in EA cross EA, semi-direct Z2.
Ah, right, Okay, if you want. But as far as I can tell, all the examples that I'm going to deal with will have an H contained just in one E8. So you don't need to worry about that. Yes, this is a possible freedom. So this is the gauge loop. And F-theory compactification looks higher dimensional. So you can think of it as compactified on a Calabi-Yau fourfold Y, which in turn is elliptically fibered over a non-Calabi-Yau threefold base B. This is an elliptic fibration. And you can think of this as a 2B compactification on B3 with varying dilaton. So the complex structure is identified with, of the elliptic curve is identified with the complexified dilaton. Something like A plus E to the I E to the minus phi. I am going to focus today purely on the algebraic aspects of the story. So to me, the key ingredient is the discriminant. So this vibration determines a discriminant hypersurface, which algebraically is simply given by the locus where the elliptic fibers degenerate. Roughly, you would say the tau goes to infinity. And then there are metric characterizations of that, but like I said, I'll focus on the algebraic aspects. So an old story is the duality between the hadronic theory and F theory. Basically, it says that if your Y4 is elliptically fibered over B3, which is in turn a P1 bundle over another variety B2. So this is a P1 fiber, this is a T2, or an elliptic curve. Such way that when you combine, you get a K3 fiber. So the story is that this is dual to a heterotic compactification on Z and before on the same B2. And you see this best in the geometric or stable limit, which is, if you work one point at a time in the base, you let your K3 split into the union of two rational elliptic surfaces, or DP9s for short, intersecting along an elliptic fiber. So a DP9 is something which is fibered over P1 with elliptic fibers. You pick a fiber here and glue it a fiber there. That is a well-known, well-understood limit of K3 surfaces, and then you do this uniformly over the base B2. So if you do this over the base B2, you get that Y4 degenerates to the union of two pieces. Let's call them W plus union W minus. Each of these is a fourfold, which is fibered over B2 with these DP9 fibers. And the intersection of W plus and W minus is going to be exactly the heterotic threefold Z. Right, so we have one elliptic curve, you fiber it over the base, you get a threefold. That is the Z that will occur in the heterotic story. So very crudely, you say that there's an equivalence between a Delpezzo 9 together with the choice of an elliptic curve in it and the same elliptic curve together with an E8 bundle on it. So this is a purely formal equivalence to give in. Well, this E8 bundle is going to satisfy some properties that it's going to be semi-stable. Such bundles come from T bundles, where T is the maximal torus of E8. A T bundle is given by a homomorphism from some from the E8 lattice to the Picard group of the elliptic curve. That map is exactly given by restriction under this inclusion. So the cohomology of the delta 8, so 9, has a certain primitive piece which is isomorphic to the E8 lattice. The inclusion gives you a map from this to the cohomology of the elliptic curve, and which is out of that you get your family of line bundles on the elliptic curve parameterized by this lattice that gives you a E8 bundle. It turns out there's a certain ambiguity on both sides, which is exactly the Weyl group. You divide by it and you get exactly a corresponding. So when you do this uniformly over B2, you get the spectral construction, or another name for it is the Fourier-Mukai transform. Which takes this heterotic data, which is the what?
So on one side you have a DP9 with an elliptic curve and
yes.
The other side you have an elliptic curve with a E8 bundle.
That's right.
Curve.
And those are equivalent data.
Not an isomorphism class of E8 bundles, but an actual E8 bundle. Because an E8 bundle is classified by a four form.
Yeah. These are S equivalence classes of those. You know, it's points in the moduli space. There are all kinds of fine details that I will not make any difference for this talk. A general semi-stable bundle is a direct sum of line bundles. Sometimes, for some very special points in moduli, instead of direct sum, you can have non-trivial extensions when a bundle repeats. But then with an S equivalence class basically tells you to forget such extensions to set to things equal if the graded pieces are the same. So that's the data that you actually cover. And then there are fine issues about each S equivalence class has a unique representative that's semi-simple, which means it's actually a sum of bundles, and also has a representative which is regular, which basically means it's as far from semi-simple as possible. All the possible extensions are non-zero. So in some sense, it's really the regular ones that fit in the most naturally. But trust me, none of that has any relevance to the talk today.
The topological class you're referring to, which is the four-form class, is trivial for the elliptic curve. So there's no topological.
So you just have a, so it's actually the bundle.
These are degree zero bundles.
You can think of Hermitian. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's what you're saying. Yeah. So it's an E8 bundle plus some.
What he would say is if it's a holomorphic E8 bundle.
It's a holomorphic E8 bundle.
The topology is trivial, and I'm.
Yeah. It's more than that. Yeah. Flat E8 bundle.
You have to quote some theorem to know the equivalence of these two pieces of data. But and a person trained in algebraic geometry will often think of them as holomorphic bundles.
Yes, and like I said, I'm just trying to get into the F theory. One of several punchlines is going to be that the interesting corner of F theory for complexification is one which is disjoint from this. These will be F theory complexifications that do not have a heterotic dual. So this is a bit of an intro, but it's not really going to be very useful, very important. So um, we're interested in four-dimensional compactification, but you could start by asking about six-dimensional or even eight-dimensional compactifications. In eight dimensions, it's a very well-known correspondence between K3 moduli and elliptic curves with a pair of bundles. In six dimensions, there is some very beautiful work of Bay and Kamon Vafa, where the thing that I'm calling B2, the base, well, it's no longer two-dimensional. All my dimensions are going to be complex. So when I say two-dimensional, it really means four real dimensional. So my B2 is actually going to be one-dimensional in this analogy. So it just becomes P1. And B3 becomes a Hertzsprung surface. FN, and for historical reasons that I think began in their paper, the index is called T rather than N. I think that comes from your paper, but I'm not sure.
Either, it's a long time ago.
Right. And the Y is no longer fourfold, it's now Calabi-Yau threefold, which is elliptically fibered over the Hertzsprung surface. Is this too low here? Can people see this? I won't go lower than that. Z becomes a surface, so it's a K3 surface. And one thing that they noted in that paper is that the distribution of the Chern classes between the two VIs, well, the sum has to cancel the C2 over the K3, which is 24. So these things are centered at 12, and they're going to be 12 plus and minus T, the same T that shows up here in the geometry of the Hertzsprung surface. So this is the projectivization over the base B, which happens to be P1, of the line bundle, which is O direct sum T. This T, you can think of it as the conormal to the zero section. Anyway, it's a particular P1 bundle. It's a projectivization of rank 2 vector bundle. And this T will be C1 of the bundle T. So it's just the degree of the bundle that determines the geometry of this P1 fibration. And
you just said that capital T is O of T, O of little t.
Well, I'm thinking of capital T as a line bundle and little t as it's a cohomology class. Pardon?
Curly O of little t.
That's a direct sum. O direct sum T. Okay. So the analog in four dimensions is B3 is still going to be projectivization over B2. Of a similar setting, O plus T, and there will be a class T, which is C1 of T. Now everything is in one dimension higher. The second Chern class of the two bundles, V1 and V2, or V plus V minus, are going to be eta, V1, V2, which is 6 times C1 of the base, plus or minus T. C1 of P1 was 2. 2 times 6 gives me the 12 that I had in that formula. So this is the natural generalization. OK.
Sorry, Ron.
Yeah.
So C2 is, I usually think of as a 4 form, degree 4 cohomology class.
Right.
Little t I think of as a number. C1 is a.
So these are, this is a class. T is on B2, and this is on B3. So.
Just having a very elementary problem with degrees of cohomology classes. C2 is an H4 or something.
Wedge with the fiber.
Yeah. So these are classes.
C1 is capital T. Okay.
These are classes on B2, which I think of as being the zero section sitting inside B3. So there's a shift in dimension. So I guess it's this I lower star.
Okay.
Now you're happy?
Okay.
A Gaussian map or inclusion, whatever. Okay, so, I mean, but you're right, on the face of it, this is a one form, that's a two form. So the work with Gottfried Curio was aimed at establishing explicitly the dictionary between various quantities on the two sides of this duality. And basically, we considered the moduli in hydraulic versus F. And we calculated them on both sides and showed that under this duality, indeed, the things do match. So there are two geometric objects that are key to this. On the F theory side, you have an ADE Delpezzo vibration. So you have a Delpezzo, except it is forced to have singularities governed by your gauge group, G. So G is going to determine some group that will determine a type of singularity. You'll have a family of Delpezzos, all of them having the same type of singularity, or at least that much singularity. While on the heterotic side, the corresponding object is going to be a spectral cover. So the ADE vibration is basically Y4 over B2. And the spectral cover is going to be some finite cover C of the same B2. The details, again, I'm shoving under the rug. They depend on exactly which group you have. So if your structure group is an SUN group, then you really have just a usual good old N-sheeted cover. In more complicated cases, like if the structure group itself is the full E8, then there is no good analog of the spectral cover. You need to do something slightly more group theoretic. You look at a chemical cover, which is just a formal group theoretic way of encoding the information. So varying them over B2, you get two local systems. So at each point of B2, you have a lattice. The lattices move around. There will be a discriminant curve in the base over which the thing will blow up. You'll have local monodromy around that. Other than that, it will give you a local system. So these are two local systems on an open subset in B2. B2 is the common base to the heterotic and F vibration.
You're not telling this, you're not giving this explicit examples of B2. It's just some algebraic twofold.
That's right. So I am going to finish the talk with some concrete examples. But at this level, this is just a mathematical result that does not require anything to be Calabi-Yau. It will work over any base B2. So B2 can be any surface, and in fact, with not much effort, you can take B2 to have any dimension as well. So I have two local systems. One is the fibers are going to be H2 of the ADE surface versus H0 of the fibers of C over B2. So these fibers are finite. These fibers are surfaces. H2 of the surface gets related to H0 of the fiber. Unfortunately, it is related and not equated. There's a certain amount of rather complicated linear algebra that comes in, but just take my word that it can be handled. So you work with these local systems, and the point is that the essential piece of this local system can be identified under the heterotic F-theory duality with the essential piece of these two, which gives you equivalences of moduli. So this underlies the identification of all moduli in F theory versus heterotic theory. So heterotic versus F. So here's data that derives from the spectral cover C, and here's data that derives from, call it X or Y, call it Y. So for example, we can look at H20 of C, and that gets identified with H31 of Y4 and is interpreted in terms of complex deformations of X preserving singularity type. So that is one chunk of the moduli that you have. Another piece is given by H10 here and H21 there. So this is something that is most interesting in six-dimensional complexifications, where C is a curve and Y is a threefold, and then it basically gives you that the prim of C, some part of the Jacobian of C, gets identified with the intermediate Jacobian of this threefold. So in physics language, this will give you some Ramon fields of the complexification, and this lets you see them on the heterotic side through the duality. And we have a piece involving H11 versus H22. So this is the one that governs the fluxes. This is going to be a discrete piece that governs the fluxes that you have in the theory. So in one side, it's classes that are in the kernel of pile or star of the Dirac map image. On the other side, it would be primitive classes, things that are perpendicular to wedging with the Kähler class. So the key ingredient in checking this correspondence is the cylinder map. Which roughly says that a point of C corresponds to a section of the DP9 fibration, which is disjoint from the zero section and disjoint from the singularities. So in a slightly different version, you think of these DP9s as giving you delpezzos of some lower degrees, and these give you lines on these lower degree delpezzos. So as you move around, you have a family of surfaces. So this is a family of two-dimensional objects, but I can extract from them in a natural way a finite set. What's the finite set? It's the set of lines on the delpezzo, or the set of sections of the DP9 that are disjoint from the zero section. It turns out that there's a finite number of them. If you have the full gauge group, then the number would be 240, and then it'll go down with a group. And if you trace the finite cover that you get from the lines of these delpezzos, it will exactly give you C. A point of C corresponds one-to-one to one of those lines. And you see that there's a Giesen situation going in here. So a point here gives you a line in there, which accounts for the dimension shift of 2 in the cohomology, where it's really a shift of 1-1, going from 2-0 to 3-1, 1-0 to 2-1, and so on. So it really is just an induced map coming from this cylinder map. So if you want to derive the equivalence of these moduli by hand, you just start with this and see what this map induces and check that all the maps are isomorphism. So just to point out that this has some non trivial aspects. So for example, the correspondence induced on fluxes has the following peculiar features. There's a non-integrality involved, which says that on one side, your flux, on the heterotic side, your flux is going to be given by some class gamma, which can be written as the first Chern class of C minus pullback of the first Chern class of the base divided by 2 plus something, which is the Chern class of an honest line. The problem is that this difference may not be even, may not be divisible by 2. So the claim is that the classes that you do get as flux classes on the heterotic theory are not necessarily integral. The shift is given by half of this difference, which as compared to honest line bundles.
That's the flux of what?
Well, let me finish the sentence, and maybe we'll be able to answer that. These gammas are the ones that correspond to G's that are fluxes on the F theory side. So these G's are going to have a formula like C2 of the Calabi-Yau divided by 2 plus some integral class, something like that. So
I'm lost. There's a fourth form in 2A. I mean, F theory, if I'm thinking of F theory, I think this talk is thinking of F theory as a particular kind of compactification of 2B.
Yes.
Right. So, well, memory serves, we have 1, 3, and 5.
Right. F theory fluxes really are often described in M theory. So that's G flux in
M theory. That's the G flux in the M theory. Okay.
So you can turn it into an H.
I see. So, but it should be G. So it lives on Y4.
Yeah.
So this is a degree 4 class of Y4.
Exactly.
So this is. Oh no! I see. So this is satisfying the usual Witten quantization.
Yeah, yeah. That is supposed to be the Witten quantization. What I'm saying is, the classes that correspond to this G are. If you work out through this correspondence, these are the classes that you get on the heterotic side.
It's like a push forward of H or something in the heterotic theory, one dimensional.
I don't think he's claiming that it's actually a flux in the heterotic.
No, I'm not claiming anything.
What is gamma? What is the interpretation of gamma?
That is the data that matches G under. Under the correspondence.
If I think about heterotic M theory, then I know that G, so if I contract G on the boundaries, then I get the three form, right?
The G's on the F theory.
Yeah, I got it. So you told me, and I think I accept that, to think of G in M theory. We better think of heterotic M theory.
No, I think we're in theory Q3 fiber.
Ah. But where am I getting the A cross the 8?
Well, the A cross the 8 is coming about because we have this degeneration.
Oh, thank you. Okay, sorry. Okay. Okay, that's really helpful. So we've got M theory on this Y4. Right, and so alpha is just some integral class?
That's right. Well,
and
this point is, in order to figure out what, in order to translate a class which could support G-flux from F theory to the heterotic side, we need to deal with the Witten quantization condition, and happily, the natural formula has the same structure of an integral class plus a half integral guy, which turns out to correspond to half C2 on the Y4. But he's not telling us what the physical meaning of the gamma is.
Yeah, so that clearly doesn't help until I'm done.
Let me withdraw the statement. I claim that a meaning can be assigned to it, but I don't think I can produce it right now.
Related to the gauge, just the gauge bundle, the curvature of the gauge bundle, the gamma. I mean, it's the two form, right? You're treating
yes.
It, I mean, it could only be the gauge bundle. I just.
Right, but what's the meaning of the non-integrality? I was I've tried that before and gotten confused about it, which is why I'm not going to try to answer Greg's question.
I mean, maybe your gauge bundle is actually a twisted bundle. Do you have a non-trivial gerb on the
heterosexual? I am not sure how to answer. So if I may, I will just withdraw that comment.
In F theory, the G-flag reduced along the singular flag will give you the non-integral quaternary gauge flags, right, on the seven. This will incorporate the pre-written quantization condition for the gauge flags on that theory, so it should do the same also on that.
No, but that's type 2B language. I mean, he's asking an erotic question.
Yes, but since it manifests itself in quantization shift in the gauge flux on the ergodic side, it should do so also for U1 flux. The F theory side should do the same for U1 flux.
Yeah. That's a confused remark. The Fried-Witten anomaly is about capital W3 and H3. Not about the shift, the spin.
All right, guys, I'm going to call the question and move on. There are a couple of other subtle points that I just wanted to pick off. One is that there is a restriction, a permittivity type restriction in both theories, and again we check that those matches. So there's the kernel of pi lower star on one side versus permittivity on the F side. So they go to each other under this correspondence. And there's also a matching of the N5 number on one side versus the N3 number on the other side, the number of 5 brains and the number of 3 brains that are required. The formula for the number of 5 brains determined by some gamma is going to be N5 of what you get without a gamma, with a correction of half gamma squared, basically, while the formula for the number of 3 brains in F theory is, again, a basic number, which is the Euler characteristic divided by 24 by Sethi Vafa-Witten. And the correction given by the flux is minus half g squared. So this says that gamma squared behaves like minus g squared. And gamma is in the middle dimensional cohomology of C. G is in the middle dimensional cohomology of Y4. Both of those square to a number. The compatibility you need is that there's a minus one sign between them. And that, roughly speaking, expresses the fact that this correspondence came from integrating over these lines or sections inside the Del Pezzo, and those had self-intersection minus one. So when you trace the effect of going from H2 to H4, you're multiplying by the self-intersection of the line, which is minus one.
It's also compatible with the sign of Hodge index in primitive class.
Right, it better be. Yeah. But how do you know that it's minus one rather than minus 60? 60 is actually a very likely number in that story. It comes from the fact that the square intersection, self-intersection of a line is minus one, just roughly speaking. Anyway, it was a nice story, but it was useless for phenomenology because it didn't mention matter. Correspondence at the level of moduli. So it's not clear why, but nobody picked it up for 10 years until DW1, and then shortly after that, there were similar results in the first paper by Beasley, Vafa, and Heckman. And in a paper by Hayashi, Tatar, Toda, Watari, and Yamazaki. And as a combination of these three papers, or the results I'll mention actually in the intersection of those three papers, you can match the matter content across the satirotic activity drug. In particular, you have formulas for the types of matter available in an F-theory compactification, and you can check that they indeed match the heterotic story. Let me first give the picture, and then I'll give just a little bit of details of how you derive it. This is sort of a slogan level picture. So you have seven brains. This is the picture in F theory, which are complex surfaces for a poor algebraic geometer, private over the base. And you have curves, and you have points. The seven brains are going to correspond, these are going to be in B3. So you think of F theory is really living in B3. Think of it as a type 2B on B3 with varying dilatation. So these seven brains are going to correspond to components of the discriminant delta. So delta may be irreducible, or it may have several components. And these are going to be the relevant surfaces for the story. And then the intersection of two components is going to give you a curve, and the intersection of three components is going to give you the points. And the quick version of the dictionary, or of the interpretation of F theory matter, is that the gauge fields live on the seven brains. The bifundamental chiral matter lives on the intersection of two brains, charged under the gauge fields from those two. And the Yukawa couplings live on the triple intersections. So it's a very clean, very satisfying picture. And what it clearly suggests is that you want to study local models. You want to focus your attention only on neighborhoods of the brains and try to ignore the rest of the collabial. So what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the talk is that, the validity of that, and how reasonable it is to just work with a local model, and call that a phenomenological answer. So
let me just try one more. So this gamma has something to do with the C1 of the gauge bundle?
This picture is intrinsic to F theory, even in situations that do not have a heterotic dual whatsoever. So then there is no gamma, there's only the G flux. If there happens to be a heterotic dual, then you can calculate everything explicitly by going to that gamma.
Okay. But there's no interpretation of gamma in this general picture.
Exactly. But I'm going to suggest in a moment a variant in which gamma will reappear in this context as well, even when there is no heterotic dual. That's where I'm headed.
Gamma is a class on the spectral cover C, if I have that right?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not actually, so it's some derived thing from an actual flux.
Right. Yeah. And as has become clear, I do not know how to say in physics language what's the significance of this gamma, other than that mathematically it's there and it clearly corresponds to G and correspondence has a lot of good properties. Maybe in the interest of time, I will skip some of the details of how this is derived. You may have already heard some of that from that. Okay. Yeah. So you can do sort of an array sequence type calculation using the Fourier-Mukai transform. I'm sure it's different than what she was doing, but at least in cases where these things do have a heterotic dual, then you can think of the bundle V as, well, it lives on the heterotic threefold, but when you try to calculate its cohomology, which is the matter contribution, you find that it is supported on a certain curve inside the spiral cover. So you have the spiral cover C, and it intersects the zero section of the vibration. That intersection is the matter curve. That is where your matter is supported in the heterotic picture. So that gets dualized to these curves in the F theory, which are the intersections of pairs of brains. The typical picture, there is one main brain, which you call the gauge brain, and it carries some gauge group G. And then the rest of delta, the other components, have just I1 singularities. So no gauge. So you call those matter brain. And so you put the gauge brain along the zero section, and you have a matter brain that comes in and sometimes does this and sometimes does that and sometimes might do this and so on. And along the intersections is where you get matter. It's not going to be bifundamental, it'll just be charged under the single gauge group. And the pattern of intersections will determine the type of the charge that you carry. And you can work it out in detail, which I will not do. Let me just mention the one type that I will need. So for example, we'll take the group to be SU5. So that lives along this zero section. And it turns out that then there are two basic types of intersections of the I1 brain with the SU5. So it can be enhanced to either SU6 or SO10 or spin10 or whatever you want to call that. If you go to SU6, you get that the adjoint representation, which is 35 dimensional, splits as a 24 dimensional thing, which charge 0 under the I1, plus a 5 minus 1 and a 5 bar 1 and a neutral 1. While in this case, your adjoint representation is going to be 45, 10 times 9 over 2, 45 dimensional. It still has the 24, 0, but then it has a 10 with charge 2 and a 10 bar with charge minus 2 and the neutral piece. So these give rise to, realistic models, these give rise to two parts of the matter curve. You have a sigma 10 and a sigma 5. The 10 is a commutant of the 5, and the 5 is a commutant of the 10. So this sigma 10 gives you the possible enhancements of SU5 with an I1 to an SU6, while the sigma 5 gives you enhancement to SO10. So global versus local. So a global model for F theory is given by an elliptic fibration, which you can write maybe as y squared equals x cubed plus fx plus g. This is the Weyl stress form. Or a more elaborate form called the Tate form is y squared plus a1xy plus a3y equals x cubed plus a2x squared, a4x, and a6. And of course, you can go back and forth between them by completing the square, making affine changes of variables. But according to Tate's algorithm, which is beautifully explained for physicists by a famous six-author paper, the Tate form is the one that's more useful for detecting the types of singularities. So this is supposed to represent an elliptic fibration contained in the total space of K b3 to the minus 2 direct sum kb3 to the minus 3. So this is a rank 2 vector bundle over b3, and you write down one equation in it. That equation, that gives you your fourfold, the family of elliptic curves. I'm sorry?
That's the affine. You should project away.
Yes, I could, but I... which is also contain a projectivization of the same thing plus O, if you want the compact version. So here the AIs, in order to make sense of this, you need the AIs to be global sections over B3 of KB3 to the minus I, which gives you some formulas for delta and so on. And Tate's algorithm tells you that in order to have a component of delta with a particular gauge group, you need some specific conditions on the vanishing orders of the AIs along that component. And I'll work it out explicitly only in the one case of SU5 for the purposes of this talk. Put this one away. Okay. So let's assume that we have S, which is a given component of delta. Assume that it is a non-singular surface. And let's say Z is a normal direction coordinate locally. So pick a point of S and so the equation of S in some local coordinate is given by Z equals 0. And a little later, I'll probably switch Z to S. So little z and little s are the same thing. So the capital T that we had before becomes the conormal bundle to S in B3. So T, little t is minus the first Chern class of the normal bundle, just as before. So, for example, in order to get SU5 singularities along S, or along Z equals 0, you need A1 to be anything it wants to be, A2 needs to be divisible by Z, Z times, let's call it B4. A3 is going to be Z squared times B3. A4 is going to be Z cubed times B2. And A6 is going to be Z to the fifth times B0. In principle, these should be thought of only as the leading terms, and then you can have higher order terms. Or you can think of the B's as being functions themselves. So either you think of the B's as functions, or you think of the B's as constant, then they're only the leading order term and they're higher order terms. So here, the BIs with this particular notation are going to be sections on S of 6 minus I times C1 minus that class T over there. And the whole equation is homogeneous. It lives in KB3 to the minus 6. For other groups, you will have a very similar pattern. You'll just be changing the powers of Z that need to be extractable from the coefficients. The essence of going from global to local is simply ignore the higher order terms. In other words, forget the dot dot dots. Set them equal to zero. So what does that do? It replaces the original equation by an ALE vibration. If you look at the equation, so for in the example that we have, you of SU5, you'll get y squared equals x cubed plus b0 z to the fifth plus b2 z cubed x b3 z squared y b4 z x squared and b5 xy. A priori had this plus higher order terms. If I ignore those terms, this is just the equation of an ALE surface with SU5 singularities. So I'm making it quasi-homogeneous or whatever by ignoring the higher order terms. This is the local model. So when people talk about constructing local models of F-theory, they're talking about something which, instead of being a compact Calabi-Yau, is just an ALE vibration over the surface base. The point of the dictionary that that just got erased is that this contains all the information you need, because all the information is local around the brains.
Could you make that a little more obvious? I mean, if everything, if the B is with higher index with non-zero subscript, we're
right.
Zero,
so let me tell you now.
It, A8 singularity.
Yes.
But why is this an SU5
singularity? Well, if you set all the Bs except for B0 to zero, this is an E8 singularity. If you set all the Bs to have generic values, this is an SU5 singularity.
Is that supposed to be obvious?
Well, you just have to look it up.
B0 are the two obvious terms.
If B, you need B5 to be non-zero, that's it.
Okay. Thank you. Got it. Okay.
And does this local model have also a local Calabi-Yau metric?
It is a Calabi-Yau, but a non-compact one. That's all I can say.
Can't we build Kronheimer or something like that?
I think it's a vibration.
Oh, it's a vibration.
It's not just something
non-compact.
I don't know if you need one. I just wanted to see.
You can need one, don't you?
I think so, but I feel responsible only for the algebraic geometry part of the story.
I mean, it's essentially a cone over a phono, and so if you can conclude that that Fano has an Einstein metric. However, the hypotheses needed for Einstein metrics on Fano, threefolds, is not so obvious.
Shouldn't this just be limiting? I mean, if there's a Clavier metric on the original space, I mean, I'll be just zooming in.
You are zooming in, but it's not exactly clear what that means. Let me say what it means.
That kind of reasoning is extremely useful, mainly because we don't have the tools to do anything on this.
All right. What is going on here? Well, I believe that the algebraic language for this is degeneration to the normal bundle. So in general, given a space which we'll call B3 and a subspace which we'll call S, you can create a space of dimension 1 bigger than B3, which is fibered over the affine line or over P1 in such a way that all the fibers are isomorphic to B3 except one, which is isomorphic to the conormal bundle of S in B3, assuming that S and B3 are smooth. And with singularities, there's a variant called degeneration to the normal cone instead of the normal bundle. So a very useful example is take the B3 and take that to be a K3 surface, and take S and take that to be a curve in the K3. And that gives you a degeneration. You can see it explicitly. You take the K3 and you stick it inside a space, a projective space, PG, in such a way that C is a hyperplane section embedded canonically in PG minus 1. And then you stick the whole thing inside PG plus 1. And you take the cone on K3. So this is a threefold. So you pick a point of PG plus 1 complementary to PG, and you actually cone it off to a singular threefold. It contains K3, and there's also a projection backwards, except at the vertex. And projection from from the center PG minus 1 gives you a map of the whole space, in particular the cone of K3, to there's a pencil of hyperplanes. It gives you a map to P1, and it's everywhere defined except along the curve C, which gets blown up. So the blow up of this, this is bad. You take the cone on K3 and blow it up along the curve C, then the map actually becomes a morphism. And this is your degeneration to the normal cone in this case. If you think about it, you have the cone and you're slicing it by a family of hyperplanes. Almost any hyperplane is going to cut the cone in something isomorphic to the original K3 surface, except for the hyperplane that goes to the vertex, which will cut it in a cone over the curve. That cone over the curve is basically the conormal bundle where you collapse the section at infinity. If you follow this line of thought, according to a paper I wrote with Klein and Lazarsfeld, this gives you the degeneration of the Mukai system, which is an integrable system living on a K3 surface, depending on this curve C, to the Hitchin system, which lives just on the cotangent bundle of C. So just that in some context. Anyway, so I believe this is exactly what's happening in this general situation where we're going from a global Calabi-Yau to a local Calabi-Yau. Okay, so Let me skip a few details here. So the point is that there are a lot of constraints. Not every local model can arise from a global model. If you look through much of the recent literature on models of F-theory, with very few, if any, exceptions, they all construct local models. It is easy, and it's very natural, given that the geometry depends only on the local data. But just as in heterotic models, you have constraints to satisfy. Your bundle needs to be stable or polystable. It needs to satisfy anomaly cancellation. It's very easy to construct models where only some of these assumptions work and others don't. It seems to be similar in F theory. There's some conservation of effort. You can construct a lot of models easily in the local world, but that just seems to shift a lot of the difficulty into extending them to global models. So let me explain a couple of possibilities for these constraints. So from tadpole cancellation, let me just state the results. Let's say for SU, in the SU5 case always. So you work out explicitly the equation of the discriminant in local coordinates. You get that it's z to the 5 times this leading coefficient b5 to the fourth power times r plus o of z to the 6, where this factor r is going to have some messy formula. It's going to be b0 times b5 squared minus b2, b3, b5 plus b4, b3 squared. Whatever it is. Anyway, you extract from this that the matter curves, sigma 10 and sigma 5, the loci where your gauge group is enhanced, correspond to, well, you have to look at the singularities of this. So it's given by B5 equals 0, or R equals 0. These are going to be your two matter curves. And now it's easy to calculate the cohomology classes of sigma 10 and sigma 5. The class of sigma 10 is just given by the class of B5, which is hopefully somewhere on the board. Pardon? There it is. So B5 is in C1 minus T. While you do the same combination for R, you see that all three terms are in the same place, and that place is HC1 minus 3T. Okay. So in particular, well, as it stands, that is not a constraint because t is basically a parameter, but you can eliminate t. Three times the class of sigma, well, let's do it the other way. The class of sigma 5 minus three times the class of sigma 10 should be equivalent to 5 times C1 of the surface. This is an equation that involves no t. This is an identity that must be satisfied. If you're in a local model, you can just decree, let's take this curve to be sigma 5, this curve to be sigma 10. It may or may not satisfy this equation. If you look at most of the examples in the literature, they do not satisfy it. So those are not valid. Well, they're valid in the local world, but they are not part of a of any UV completion or whatever. You cannot go to a compact Calabi-Yau that contains them. There are other examples of these constraints, but I don't want to drag this too long. Let me...
Yeah.
quickly, in the model by Beasley et al., the SU5 model?
I'm sorry?
In the SU5 model, local yes. model by Beasley et al., is that constraint satisfied or not?
Well, they have a lot of examples. I think most of them do not satisfy this. I think there are some examples they have that do satisfy it. So, most of the examples do not, I think. I would not swear. But you can just look at any given example. I'm proposing this is the first criterion that you would subject it to see whether it makes sense or not as the localization of some conceivable global model.
Should I think that this is an obstruction to coupling a field theory to gravity?
Yeah.
So this is like with the gravitational anomaly or something like that?
I'm not sure about the words, but sounds good to me.
C1 here is first term class of S, is that there, or?
C1, yeah, C1 of S, thank you.
And what are the assumptions? I mean, is this a problem that can be fixed by having something else somewhere far away?
Yeah, I mean, the assumption is that you have a theory that gives you matter only in the two basic representations, the 5 and the 10 of SU5. If you have another curve, it'll produce other matter in other representations, so it will not be a realistic model.
But suppose I have this local stuff, all this local stuff is happening in some part of the global Calabi-Yau 4.
Yes.
And then a million miles away in the Calabi-Yau 4 fold, I have some other sector.
This is to check that you can have trivial canonical bundle in a neighborhood of S.
Oh, I see. So it's not really S. Right. Oh, I see.
So it's necessary but not sufficient.
There's a condition on S itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. That says that to first order you can extend this to a Calabi-Yau. All right. So I want to introduce one last idea, which seems very beautiful. I mean, I can't say that I really understand it fully. I'm still struggling. This is in this paper that is on its way. And that is the idea of an F-theory spectral coverage. So what I want to say is that even in a situation where you have an F-theory model that does not have a heterotic dual, you can still make sense of a spectral cover by going through this degeneration to the normal bundle. So what are we saying? We are saying we have B3 containing S, and we are degenerating it somehow. Well, B3 is replaced by the projectivization of O plus T or something like that. And actually, there are two different versions you can do. You can take O plus the canonical bundle of S or O plus the normal bundle. Since B3 is not Calabi-Yau, those two are not necessarily the same. So the difference between them is this class eta that they've been floating around. Eta, exactly, is the difference between K and T. So you go from the same S sits inside these P1 bundles. And you think of this as a limit or approximation, or local limit of the original compact situation. And even though S may not be the same as the B2 that we had before, in fact, there may not be any B2 because there may not be a heterotic dual, you can still can get a spectral cover C over this S. In fact, C is going to be contained in this bundle. And it's going to intersect each fiber in endpoints, so it'll give you a finite cover of S. Well, actually, C bar is going to be in here. C is an open subset in C. The problem is that your C bar will hit the section at infinity exactly along this divisor eta, or a representative of the divisor eta. So you're dealing with meromorphic Higgs fields, or Higgs bundles on S. So phi is, so there's some bundle E, and you have a map from E to E tensor KS twisted by eta. So you can work out much of the dictionary, and it still goes through even in situations that do not have a heterotic dual, but you replace the usual spectral cover by this spectral cover. In particular, you can have fluxes and so on can be interpreted as certain line bundles on this C. So the question is, how many such classes are there on a given C? The answer is, generically, something called the Netter-Lefschetz theorem tells you that they are all inherited from the global picture. So that means that there are three, there's the cohomology of S pulled back, and there's only one additional class which you can take to be the class of sigma 10, I guess, is the most natural. So whatever it is, it has one more class than what comes from S, and the kernel of the trace map is going to be one-dimensional. It's a map from a vector space of dimension one more than the dimension of S, going to the cohomology of S. It's actually surjective. So the kernel is just one-dimensional. So you can write down an essentially unique gamma up to scalar that becomes traceless so that it gives you an allowable flux. And you can calculate the number of generations corresponding to this gamma. So this is a calculation done by Gottfried Curiel many years ago. And you get some formula that the number of generations ends up being some integer lambda over 2 times the intersection of eta and eta minus nc1. And again, I'm going to skip the details of this. So what we get is a no-go theorem that says, well, no good models exist with these assumptions. Under reasonable assumptions, which I will spell in a second, no global or globalizable solutions exist.
Three generations, is it?
That is one of the reasonable assumptions. One of three reasonable assumptions. I'll spell them out in a second. I'm not requiring standard model or anything fancy, just three generations. It's awfully hard to get them. And the second point that I want to make is that this suggests a new mechanism for stabilizing global moduli or complex moduli. So this says that with general moduli, you cannot do something. It can only be done when you tune your complex structure to some very specific values. With some luck, you can imagine hoping that this will fix or at least greatly restrict your complex moduli. So these are the last two points that I want to.
I have a question about each of them before you tell us what they are.
Okay.
So Beasley, Heckman, Vafa seem to have a way of calculating the number of generations directly in F-theory without needing a spectral cover construction and making an analogy with the heterotic computation.
That's right.
Is that getting the same result?
Yeah. It's the same with...
There
are two parts.
Why we needed the spectral cover for this?
There are two parts. Given some class for the flux, you want to calculate the number of generations. There's a simple formula. The question is, to which class are you going to apply it? What we're saying is that if your local model comes from a global model and everything is somewhat generic, there would be a unique class to which you can apply this. Applying their formula, or everybody's formula, to the unique class that is traceless will give you this answer, and then you play around and you see that you cannot get
solutions.
So that's going to
be my second question, because that's a fairly familiar phenomenon with G-flux in M-theory applications. Namely, because of the restriction of being type 2-2 together with primitivity, it severely constricts moduli to have interesting or non-trivial G-flux.
Yeah. So I missed what the question was.
It wasn't exactly a question. I guess the question is, why is this a new mechanism?
I'm saying that within F-theory, people have only looked at local models. You don't see this constraint from the local models. This is the nature of this constraint is saying that some local data should be globalizable. It will not be for generic moduli. The globalization is the constraint.
Are you saying, David, that it's the same as the G-flux constraint somehow?
So it looks completely analogous to the G-flux constraint. Mm-hmm. That's
maybe another way of phrasing the question is, does this method for stabilizing complex moduli come from stationarizing a superposition?
Does that help?
No, not really, because there is a translation of the M-theory G-flux mechanism into two kinds of three-form flux in F-theory, which is a little complicated because you've got to worry about SL2Z and so on, and it's easier to have a clear discussion if you do work in M-theory. But since you're talking about stabilizing complex moduli, it doesn't matter because complex moduli are completely mapped between the two.
Okay.
And you're telling me a construction which, on the one hand, gives the number of generations, which seems to be a generalization of your heterotic thing, for essentially specifying what the class of the G-flux is. I guess I would have said that of course, a global F-theory model has global constraints on what the G-flux classes are from the known properties already. Known properties of G-flux.
So you actually have a Netter-Lefschetz situation in that you can see in M-theory?
You've got to specify an integral 2-2 primitive class.
Right.
And that's a really, I say those words and you realize how restraining on moduli that is. If you were to hope for an integral 2-2 primitive class which left some complex moduli free, you would have to look very hard and long before you found them, right?
That's
it's the same.
Okay, so it's the same or very similar.
So I didn't mean to interrupt you from telling me what your mechanism was. I was just worried about the word new.
Right, I think I've...
Okay.
Anyway, I think I better wind this up. But the no-go assumptions, are three. One is CAD-POLE cancellation. So that's the condition that I have over there. The class, the relation between T and the class of sigma 10 and sigma 5. And locality, or contractibility, so you want to basically assume that T is M. So by Grout's criterion, that's what you need in order for S to have a chance of being contractible within the threefold. So physics where the you need the gut scale and the Planck scale should decouple, something like that. That's what you achieve by being able to contract the surface S. And well, let's say that the third condition is that the flux is inherited from the global geometry, so that that formula applies to the number of generations. Without without the last condition, if you just take one and two, they already turn out to be very constricting. Basically, there are only three possible solutions. It follows immediately from locality that the surface has to be del pezzo. In fact, when we're saying that C1 minus T has to be effective, so C1 is effective. So that way it tells you that you're in a del pezzo. The first class of solutions is to take T to be twice. Think of it, this is on a del pezzo K, with K that has to be less than or equal to 5. So H is the class of a line P2, and the EIs are the points that you blow up. So twice H minus summation, and then 1 to K EI is an example. And then the class of sigma 10 is just the hyperplane class. Or T is 3H minus summation NIEI, and NI is either 1 and 2. And you can work out, in that case, sigma 10 is going to be just some combination of the EIs. It's going to be a disjoint union of components. And the third possibility is that S is P1 plus P1, and the particular value of Q is C1. And you just apply the formula to that, and none of these gives three generations according to that formula. So the question is, can you have good classes that do give you three generations, and in fact, reasonable geometry? And well, that is still somewhat work in progress. The kind of, I promised to give examples and I ran out of time. The kind of examples you have is take B3 to be projective space with some stuff blown up. So for example, take a canonical curve of genus 4, so that's the intersection of the quadric and a cubic in P3, and blow that up. Take that to be your model for B3. And then the proper transform of the quadric is going to be your surface S. So that is P1 plus P1. There's a gut-breaking mechanism which requires that there should exist a class on S whose image in B3 is contractible, but it's not contractible on S. That mechanism works here because you take the difference of the two rulings in B3, that will be it'll be homologous to zero. So this example gives you gut breaking, and you can work out the matter curves, the Yukawa couplings, proton decay. It seems to have a fair amount of reasonable geometry. The only little problem is it doesn't seem to have any three generations. It has very nice geometry, but a lot of generations. At least if you take the flux to be generic or inherited, and we think we can construct these non-generic fluxes once you tune the moduli of that curve to specific values. So that's still underway. So, thank you.
Five questions.
How many blocks of generation?
I think the number 54 came up in one of these examples. If you're not careful, it's very easy to start exponentiating. Get completely unrealistic numbers.
So on the other hand, if you had a type 2B construction with three generations, you're saying this is not applicable to type theory?
I lost you. What do you mean by loop?
So if you had a solution in type 2B, you know, just with brains without back reaction taken into account, your claim is that cannot be lifted to FDB if it can't.
Well, unless it satisfies some constraints. Yes. Yeah, that's what we're saying. We're trying to seriously study the obstruction to lifting these local solutions, to global solutions.
You're always talking about SU5. Could you construct three generation models with SO10 or Parti-Salam or whatever?
I think we'll have. We do have an SO10 example. The problem is there; it's not exactly clear how to do the gut breaking. How to break that to? I mean, with it, how to break it within F theory to the standard model group. So we do have an example with an SO10 group that satisfies all the constraints we have, including three generations. But we're exploring possible mechanisms for breaking it, but I think that's going to be the problem there, the gut breaking.
Other questions? No? I don't see further questions. Thank you.
Thank you.